Let's take our Bibles and turn to Daniel chapter 5, if you would, please, this morning. Most of us haven't had to prove what we want most, and yet every day is an opportunity, isn't it, to prove what we want most, whether it's with our time, our conversations, our possessions. But there may be coming a time when the freedoms that we enjoy will realize that we didn't redeem the time as we ought to have. Daniel chapter 5, it's a familiar story. It's about King Belshazzar. Belshazzar, the king who's probably 25 years removed from Nebuchadnezzar. We're at the very last hours, the very last day, but the very last hours of the kingdom of Babylon. Daniel chapter 5, we'll read the chapter and then we'll pray. King Belshazzar made a great feast for 1,000 of his lords and drank wine in front of the 1,000. Belshazzar, when he tasted the wine, commanded that the vessels of gold and of silver that Nebuchadnezzar his father had taken out of the temple in Jerusalem be brought, so that the king and his lords, his wives and his concubines, might drink from them. Then they brought in the golden vessels that had been taken out of the temple, the house of God in Jerusalem, and the king and his lords, his wives and his concubines, drank from them. They drank wine and praised the gods of gold and silver, bronze, iron, wood, and stone. Immediately the fingers of a human hand appeared and wrote on the plaster of the wall of the king's palace, opposite the lampstand. The king saw the hand as it wrote. And the king's color changed. His thoughts alarmed him. His limbs gave way and his knees knocked together. The king called loudly to bring in the enchanters, Chaldeans, the astrologers. The king declared to the wise men of Babylon, "Whoever reads this writing and shows me its interpretation shall be clothed with purple, have a chain of gold around his neck, shall be the third ruler in the kingdom." Then all the king's wise men came in, but they could not read the writing or make known to the king the interpretation. And King Belshazzar was greatly alarmed, and his color changed, and his lords were perplexed. Now the queen, because of the words of the king and his lords, came into the banqueting hall, and the queen declared, "O king, live forever. Let not your thoughts alarm you, or your color change. There is a man in your kingdom in whom is the spirit of the holy gods. In the days of your father, light and understanding and wisdom like the wisdom of the gods were found in him. And King Nebuchadnezzar, your father the king, made him chief of the magicians, enchanters, Chaldeans, and astrologers, because an excellent spirit, knowledge and understanding to interpret dreams, explain riddles, and solve problems, to untie knots, were found in this Daniel, whom the king named Belteshazzar. Now let Daniel be called. He will show you the interpretation." Daniel was brought in before the king. And the king answered and said to Daniel, "You are that Daniel, one of the exiles of Judah, whom the king, my father, brought from Judah. I've heard of you, that the spirit of the gods is in you, that light and understanding, excellent wisdom are found in you. Now, the wise men, the enchanters, have been brought in before me to read this writing and to make known to me its interpretation. But they could not show the interpretation of the matter. But I've heard that you can give interpretations, that you can solve problems. Now, if you can, read the writing and make known to me its interpretation. Then you shall be clothed with purple and have a chain of gold around your neck, and you shall be the third ruler in the kingdom." Verse 17, then Daniel answered and said before the king, "Let your gifts be for yourself. Give your rewards to another. Nevertheless, I will read the writing to the king and make known to him the interpretation. You, O king," you don't see it there in the ESV, most English translations don't have the "you," but the "you" is emphatic. "You, O king, the Most High God gave Nebuchadnezzar your father kingship and greatness and glory and majesty. And because of the greatness that he gave him, all peoples, nations, and languages trembled and feared before him. Whom he would, he killed. Whom he would, he kept alive. Whom he would, he raised up. And whom he would, he humbled. But when his heart was lifted up and his spirit was hardened so that he dealt proudly, he was brought down from his kingly throne and his glory was taken away from him. He was driven from among the children of mankind, and his mind was made like that of a beast, and his dwelling was with the wild donkeys. He was fed grass like an ox, and his body was wet with the dew of heaven, until he knew that the Most High God rules the kingdom of mankind and sets over it whom he will. And here it comes back to this emphatic you. And you, his son, Belshazzar, you have not humbled your heart. You knew all that. But you have lifted up yourself against the Lord of heaven. And the vessels of his house have been brought in before you. And you and your lords and your wives and your concubines have drunk wine from them. And you have praised the gods of silver and gold, of bronze, iron, wood, and stone, which do not see, do not hear, they do not know, but the God in whose hand is your breath, and whose are all your ways, you have not honored. Then from his presence the hand was sent, and this writing was inscribed. And this is the writing that was inscribed. Mene, Mene, Tekel, and Pharsin. This is the interpretation of the matter. Mene, God has numbered the days of your kingdom and brought it to an end. Tekel, you have been weighed in the balances and found wanting. Perez, your kingdom is divided and given to the Medes and the Persians. Then Belshazzar gave the command, and Daniel was clothed with purple. A chain of gold was put around his neck, and a proclamation was made about him that he should be the third ruler in the kingdom. And that very night, Belshazzar, the Chaldean king, was killed. And Darius the Mede received the kingdom, being about 62 years old. Well, we're all familiar with the tragic story of the Titanic, that great English ocean liner that perished in 1912, though it had been said that God himself could not sink this ship. And you're probably familiar with the story of the band that stayed at its post as the passengers were loaded aboard the lifeboats, those lifeboats that numbered woefully too few. It's said that the song that they played in those final moments was "Nearer, My God, to Thee," as they reminded the passengers aboard that ship that in just moments, they'll find themselves face to face with God, which is either a comfort or a warning. Prepare to meet their Maker. Well, apparently other members of the crew were inspired by the band's commitment to duty, and despite the harrowing events, they went about straightening the deck chairs that were being carelessly knocked about amidst the chaos of that sinking ship. From these moments, we've gained that immortal phrase, arranging deck chairs on a sinking ship. It's a metaphor for any exercise in futility that's performed in the midst of certain destruction. Such was the case with King Belshazzar. He celebrated, he blasphemed, he worshipped his way to an early grave. And from his tragic story, we've gained another immortal phrase, right? The handwriting is on the wall. As we look at the story of this tragic hero, an anti-hero, if you will, what we find is a fool who rejects God, a fool who has said in his heart, "No God," or "If there is a God, I defy him." And what we find is that the fool is fooling only himself, and he can only do this for a little while. As we look at this story, as has been the case throughout the book of Daniel, what we'll find is the arrangement of the text brings us to the focal point of the text. And as I wrestled with this arrangement, trying to figure out how it all works, I was finding that center point of the story to be kind of a turning point rather than the focal point. But I think we'll see that that turning point is focal point as we work through this. Let's again see how God lays this out in his word for us. In the first few verses, verses 1 through 4, we find that the king celebrates his kingdom, and he does so with a feast. He's celebrating being king. In fact, the very first word in this story is King Belshazzar made a feast. And he's celebrating his kingdom. He's doing it in grand splendor, invites 1,000 guests, and he opens up the wine. He lays out the food. He brings in the gold. And here's a king celebrating his kingdom. When we come down to the end, we'll see that this king not only forfeits his kingdom, but he forfeits his life along with it. It's the end of the Babylonian Empire. We're ushered into a new age. We have the age of the Medes and the Persians as one era is shuffled off the stage of history and another era is ushered in. As the king throws the feast, there's a divine message that's written on the wall. And it's only at the very end of the story that we're told what this message is. It's read, it's interpreted. They couldn't read, they couldn't interpret what was written by this hand on the wall. But he saves it all the way till the end in a kind of a dramatic withholding suspense of what this message is. We see that the wise men come in to read the message and they can't. They're kept in the dark. And the way he uses dark and light in this passage is it kind of has the idea of they're kept in the dark. Though the handwriting is on the wall on the dark side of the palace, it's illuminated by the one lampstand that he mentions. Everybody can see this, but they're kept in the dark as far as what's happening. But as this message unfolds, as the sovereignty of God is recited and recounted in the presence of the king, we don't necessarily have the wise men pitted against Daniel. What we have is the wise men pitted against the fool. And that fool ends up being none other than the king himself. And the king is brought to light that he's a fool by the fact that God has been working, had been working, and he'd been rejecting the light that he'd been given and suppressing that light and holding down that light for not just hours, days, weeks, months, but years. And so the king is revealed to be a fool. As the wise men are unable to discern the message or its interpretation, the queen mother comes in, and she commends Daniel and his ability to be able to unravel knotty situations. And so she commends Daniel. The king asks him to come in, and as he's beginning to talk with Daniel, he questions Daniel's ability. Say, I've heard this may be the case. And if, in fact, this is the case, then let me reward you. Let me stoop low and give you great gifts and raise you up. And you will be honored by me, for mine is honor to give. And he speaks down to Daniel in this way. But there's, in verse 13, we're ushered into one little phrase. The very beginning of verse 13 says this: Then Daniel was brought in before the king. I'm going to argue that this morning that is the focal point of this whole passage. And we'll work through why that's the case. But as we work through this passage, what we're going to see is very quickly this morning, we're going to see nine movements on the fast track to folly. Because folly isn't someplace that you just get there by yourself. You move to folly. We all start in that stage of simplicity where we don't know what we don't know, right? But folly is choosing to remain ignorant. It's willfully ignorant. And folly never stays folly. Folly always moves that to the place where we reject and we become the scoffer. And for the scoffer, there is no hope. And that's exactly where Belshazzar finds himself at the end of this story. Nebuchadnezzar had been simplistic and even a fool. But as he worked with the revelation that had been given him, he received more. And as he put himself down and humbled himself and submitted that revelation, he was given more and more and more. Belshazzar, having been given so much revelation for so long a period of time, rejects, 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 and it's done. God's hand of mercy is stayed. So as we work through these, we're going to move through rather quickly. This morning, 9 movements on this fast track to folly. First is this. They drink from broken cisterns and empty springs. As the king throws this celebration, it comes in a certain historical context. The date is October 11th, 539 BC. October 11th, 539 BC. It's an evening. We know this date. It's recorded for us in history. There's 2 Greek historians who've recorded it for us, Herodotus and Xenophon. And there is a Babylonian historian who's recorded this for us some 300 BC or so. So we have this date recorded in history. The event at hand is a religious holiday. But it's not just any religious holiday. It's a holiday when they would be feasting. It's kind of an annual holiday. There would be revelry. There would be drunkenness. There would be orgies. There would be all sorts of debauchery taking place. But this is a certain year that this is happening, 539 BC, 2 days before this holiday event. The true king of Babylon, Nabonidus, the king father, if you will, because he was reigning in a co-regency with his son Belshazzar. Nabonidus had largely been out of the country for some 10 years because he worshipped the wrong god for the Babylonian. He worshipped the moon god. He didn't necessarily approve of Marduk or Bel, the main god of Babylon. So that put him at odds with most of the elite within Babylon. So he'd kind of been off the scene for a little bit. Belshazzar's been staying there in Babylon as the de facto king. But Nabonidus had come back as Cyrus the Great was coming to lead an army invasion against the Babylonians. And 2 days before the events recorded here in Daniel chapter 5, Nabonidus, the king, with his army, the army of Babylon, was defeated just 50 miles north of the city of Babylon. And news had reached Babylon that this was so. And Nabonidus not only was defeated, but he fled. He ran away. So now Belshazzar is left in the home territory, in the capital city. He's left holding the bag with dad gone and defeated, tail between his legs, and not coming home anytime soon. Furthermore, this army now has moved south from this victory over Nabonidus, and they've started to come and surround the city. Now, he's not really afraid at this point. For some 17 miles around this city, there's this huge wall, some 40 feet high, 25 feet thick. And that's just one. One of 4. 25 feet thick, 23 feet thick, 21 feet thick, 11 feet thick. These walls were impressive. They were impenetrable, impregnable. He wasn't real worried. He wasn't worried about water supplies. The Euphrates River, for crying out loud, ran right through the middle of the city. Now, there was a moat all the way around this city, but this Euphrates River brought in fresh water. And Herodotus, the Greek historian, says that the city was so well supplied, it had 20 years of food stores there in the city. They could outlast any army, anything that any army had to bring against them. So it's to his benefit to let life happen. It's kind of like when George Bush throws out that first pitch. He says, we're not going to let terrorists keep us from living life. And Belshazzar kind of flexes his muscle and says, we're Babylonians for crying out loud. We are the Babylonians. And no army outside our gates are going to do anything. And so he postures himself. Look again at that first word. King Belshazzar. King Belshazzar puts on a great feast. He made a great feast. Now, interestingly, we're told nothing about King Belshazzar other than he knows how to party. Okay? Nebuchadnezzar, we're told that he conquers. We're told that he brings captives. We're told that he educates. We're told that he builds. We're told all these different things that Nebuchadnezzar actually does stuff, and he has reason and substance to his glory. Belshazzar inherits glory. Nebuchadnezzar's been dead for now about 23 years. Nebuchadnezzar's son inherited the throne, and he was knocked off. And the son-in-law then inherited the throne, and after 3 years, he's knocked off. And his son takes the throne for 3 months, and he's knocked off by Belshazzar and his crew, who works it so that his aging father gets on the throne, knowing that his father doesn't have the good graces of the people, and so he knows that he can effectively be the king of the nation. So Belshazzar hasn't earned glory. He hasn't won glory. He's inherited glory. He's stolen glory. And now he throws this party. The one thing he's capable of doing is making a feast. King Belshazzar makes a great feast for 1,000 of his lords. And then this next phrase is interesting. He drank wine in front of or before the 1,000. It doesn't strike us as something strange unless we were a part of that culture. The king didn't necessarily banquet with even his lords. He'd have a separate room set up for him, the head table, if you will. He'd come out and visit. He'd maybe mingle. But he would do his own celebrating behind closed doors with his wives, with his concubines. And it would be as immoral and raucous as you could imagine. But he didn't lower himself in the presence of the peons, even though they were lords of the dominion, of the empire. But here, he seems to take a lead. He goes out in front of everybody, and he's the one who grabs the flagon. He's the one who starts the drinking contest. He's the one who begins to get himself inebriated, and that was the goal of the wine at that point. Bring out the casks, bring out the flasks, let it flow, and we're going to see how much of this we can down before sunrise. And who's standing wins. And so he starts this drinking party. And it says, as he tasted the wine, the idea is it's starting to work its effects in his body, he commands that the vessels of gold and silver be brought. He throws this party. There's great food. It's a great feast. There's great wine. It celebrates all the power of the kingdom as he invites the 1,000 highest lords. There's money. He's got golden vessels and he calls in for more. There's sex. There's everything the flesh could want at their fingertips. They're indulging. But indulgence isn't good enough. He calls for the vessels of gold and silver that Nebuchadnezzar, his father, had taken out of the temple in Jerusalem, that they be brought, that the king and his lords and his wives and his concubines might drink from them. Of all the different peoples that had been conquered and captured by Nebuchadnezzar, he singles out one people group. And he says, I want you to bring the vessels from their temple. The temple in Jerusalem, in Israel. I want you to bring those vessels to me. And the text is interesting how it says, verse 3, then they brought the golden vessels that had been taken out of the temple of Jerusalem. But it doesn't just leave it there. It inserts one more little phrase, the house of God. The house of God in Jerusalem. This wasn't just a temple like all nations have temples. This was a temple like all nations where the God of the temple was celebrated, was worshipped, was honored. But there was something different about this temple in that this God was real. And he was really present. As the worship at this temple took place, there was an interaction, an intersection between heaven and earth, where heaven was in touch with the earth, where the transcendent became immanent. There was a God who was real and was on his throne in this place. So this isn't just defying a nation and its God. This is defying the one God of all nations, and he's about to find out what it is that he's toying with. It leads to blasphemy. We don't know exactly why he chose Israel, but we know that he chose Israel and Israel's God. It may be because of Daniel's prophecies. He's probably heard from passed down line to line, king to king, that there was this young upstart in the Babylonian the Judean exiles that told the king, who had the audacity to tell the king that there's going to be another kingdom after you. Your kingdom's going to be destroyed. There's going to be a lesser kingdom. We're told that up in chapter 8, verses 1 through 4, and then verse 20, that it's the third year of Belshazzar. Nebuchadnezzar's dead. That Daniel writes down the prophecy and says, the Medo-Persian Empire is going to come in. And they're going to take the place of this Babylonian Empire. And it may be that Belshazzar heard about it, knows about it, and says, you know what? If there's one king I want to stick my finger in his eye, it's the king of those Jews. Now, Belshazzar was kind of a nasty guy. We know that he's the one who knocked off the true king in the line and the descent of Nebuchadnezzar. We know that when he was out on a hunting party one time, that in a fit of jealousy, he killed the only son of one of the generals there in Babylon. He's recorded by historians as the wicked king. He's not a nice guy. He's not accidentally tripping into blasphemy here. He's choosing to stick his finger in the eye of the God of Israel, and he's doing it on purpose. Grab these vessels so that we can drink. And as they're drinking, it says verse 4, they drank their wine and they praised God. No, they praised the gods of gold and silver and bronze and iron and wood and stone. Interestingly, those first four are given in the same order as Nebuchadnezzar's vision way back in chapter 2. Gold, silver, bronze, iron. Then we don't have the clay, we have the wood and the stone. But the point is, as this is repeated a couple different times throughout the text, that that's all these are. They're not gods that have life. They're gods fashioned out of, they're gods made by hands that are human. They're gods that didn't come down, they're gods that are built up by human hands. When Daniel references these gods, he says they don't see, they don't hear, they don't know nothing. They are nothing. That's the point as they begin to praise these gods. So there's blasphemy and then there's idolatry. So as we move through this, we see that they're drinking from cisterns that are broken, from springs that are empty. They're drinking at the pools that have nothing to give. There's nothing to quench their thirst. The money, the sex, the rebellion, the power. It's not going to fill. It's not going to satisfy. It's going to leave them empty on the verge of their own destruction. Number two, this won't take as long. We see that they move to discovering a fear that's absolutely sobering. Verse 4, they drank the wine. Verse 5, immediately the fingers of a human hand appear immediately. What's interesting is that this human hand is animate. It moves. A human hand appeared and wrote on the plaster of the wall of the king's palace. And just to highlight how accurate the Bible is, as the excavators were digging through the rubbles of ancient Babylon back in 1899, they found the throne room. And they said, this is rather interesting. Every wall on this throne room is covered with gypsum plaster. It's exactly where the hand was writing on the wall. He says, let it be known. The archaeologist said, let it be known. We have found the place where this event took place. It's almost bone-chilling how accurate the Bible is over thousands of years. But what we find is not the hand of a God who's gold, the hand of a God who's stone, the hand of a God who's wood. What we find is a hand of a God who's alive. And he's writing on the wall. And it's visible. It's on the wall opposite the lampstand so that it's shined. It's highlighted. It's up there so that everybody can see it. And the king himself sees that this hand is writing. And the result is, verse 6, the king's color changed. He went white as a ghost, we would say. His thoughts terrorized him. He's not having a nightmare, he's having a daymare. This is terror. This is absolutely terrifying. He's alarmed. And then it says, his limbs gave way. Literally, the knots of his loins were released. And most scholars tend to think that this is probably a euphemism for the fact that everything that holds things in let things out. He wet his pants. Or he messed his britches. We don't know which one. But I find it interesting that inevitably the man who's too big for his britches winds up messing his britches. Isn't that the case? And God seems to use this incontinence of the king to just highlight the absolute folly of the man who would stand against God. And not only does he literally wet his pants in the presence of God, it says his knees knocked, and he can't even stand. He can't even stand in front of this God. He's so terrified. It's interesting that when God shows up in Scripture, he's not the buddy. He's God. And even John, who's part of the inner three, in fact, he calls himself the beloved disciple, the one that Jesus loved. When John sees Jesus in his glory, it says he fell down on his face as though dead. My friend, you will not be able to stand in front of the God who looks at everything in your life and reviews it. You can't stand before him. And Nebuchadnezzar, or Belshazzar here, sees that there's a power that's bigger than him, and it absolutely terrifies him. In discovering this fear, he finds that man has no answers. Where does every king go when he finds himself in one of these situations where the gods seem to be talking? He always goes to the wise men, right? He always goes to the PhD. He always goes to the experts. He always goes to the experts. And what he finds is that the experts have no idea what they're talking about. In fact, they're left speechless. He says, all you have to do is read this and tell me what it means. They can't tell him what they mean because they can't even read it. We don't know why, because later on it's written in Aramaic. It's recorded for us in words that are Aramaic. We don't know why they couldn't read it. Maybe the letters were in script. Maybe they were written up and down. Rembrandt has a painting where the words are written up and down rather than from right to left, as it was normally written. We don't know why. We're just told they couldn't. We're told that Daniel can. But we find that he goes to another source for wisdom. These guys are clear-headed. They weren't a part of the feast. They're not inebriated. With absolute clarity, they say, I don't know. Sorry, got nothing. Empty. Then we find the queen comes in. And she enters into the feast uninvited, interestingly. Verse 10, the queen, because of the words of the king and his lords, there's kind of a ruckus throughout the palace. She comes into the banqueting hall. Apparently, this is the queen mother, because the other wives of the king are already there. So this is probably the queen mother. She is familiar with history, as though she were an eyewitness, and she's been in the palace for some time. She comes in. She gives the deference to this young man and says, O king, live forever. Don't let your thoughts alarm you. Don't let your color be changed. There is a man in your kingdom in whom is the spirit of the holy gods. You're the king. May you live forever. You've got a kingdom. It's vast, it's broad, it's big, it's influential. There is a man in your kingdom of which you are the king. But he has the gods in his corner. He has contact with the gods. Not just the gods, the holy gods. And she's speaking as a pagan, but she's tying a word to the gods that most Babylonians didn't. The gods of Babylon weren't considered holy. They were considered powerful, but they weren't considered holy. She said, he has the spirit of the holy gods. in him. When Belshazzar talks to Daniel later, he kind of skips that word. It's kind of a non-important word. It's kind of a throwaway word. You got the gods on your side. That's all I care about. This man has the holy gods in his corner. And he says, he tells him, verse 11, in the days of your father, light and understanding and wisdom like the wisdom of the gods were found in him. First thing she says, light, 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 light. He brings to light that which is dark. He brings light into the room that is darkened by the questions and perplexities of this world. In fact, your father, King Nebuchadnezzar, the king, made him chief of all the magicians, all the enchanters, all the Chaldeans, all the astrologers. You should know this guy, Belshazzar. You should know. Nebuchadnezzar died in 562 BC. Belshazzar was functioning in a capacity that was official for the entire kingdom in 560 BC. He was a part of the royal household, the palace, people, if you will. He saw, he knew some of these things that were happening. And so she says, because excellent spirit, knowledge, understanding to interpret all these things were found in this Daniel, your father raised him to this position. So she says at the end of verse 12, now let Daniel be called, and he'll show you the interpretation. She recounts for him, listen, the king, the one who didn't just inherit glory, but who built glory, who earned glory, who won glory, that king recognized this man as glorious. He put in positions of power. He's still alive. He's outlasted the king, just like chapter 1 said. He's outlasted the king. Call him. Now, do you see what name she calls him by? Look again, verse 12. Verse 11, she calls him a man in your kingdom. Verse 12, these things were found in Daniel, whom the king named Belteshazzar. But she doesn't call him Belteshazzar. She says, now let Daniel be called. Apparently Nebuchadnezzar was so impressed with this man, chapter 4, that he calls him Daniel. He doesn't call him Belteshazzar. He introduces him to his kingdom as the one that I called Belteshazzar, but his name is Daniel. His real name is Daniel. She says, let Daniel be called. Daniel, the Hebrew named after his God, let him be called. Now we come to verse 13. Then Daniel is brought in front of the king. Daniel is brought in to the king. And with Daniel stepping into the king's presence, we have nothing less than a divine confrontation. Because what does Daniel mean? Daniel means God is my judge. And all of a sudden, the one who represents the judge of all the universe steps in front of the king, the greatest king of the day, at least for a day. And one man steps into his presence and says, King, you're going to answer to God. You must give account of your kingship to this God. And that's exactly what Daniel is going to do. He's going to stick his bony finger in the face of this king, just like the prophets of old, and he's going to speak truth to power, is the phrase that everybody loves to use today. But he's going to speak truth. And it doesn't matter who's on the throne. It doesn't matter what gifts he has to give. This is the message, and it's from God, because God is bigger than anybody else, even you. And so Daniel's going to come in, and with Daniel coming in, we have the entrance of God is my judge. That reality becomes a reality at this moment. From there, everything changes. The king starts to interview Daniel, and rather than acknowledging his abilities, he starts to exercise his manipulative tactics. Daniel, the light bringer, the knot untier, he starts to manipulate as though he were still in control. Look at how he talks to Daniel. Verse 13. Then the king answered and said to Daniel, So, are you that Daniel, one of those exiles of Judah? whom my king, the father, brought from Judah? Are you one of those slaves that we captured so many years ago? I'm the king. My father was the king before me, and you are a captive. Just wondering, are you that, Daniel? Kind of rubbing it in his face just a little bit. Again, on purpose in what he's doing. He says, I've heard of you, that the spirit of the gods is in you, as though your God were one of many, that light and understanding and excellent wisdom are found in you. Now, I want you to know that my wise men, the enchanters, they've been brought in to read this writing and to make known to me its interpretation, but they could not. But I've heard that you can. So if you can read the writing and tell me its interpretation, then I'll tell you what I'll do for you. I'll tell you what I'm going to do. He sounds like a used car salesman at this point, doesn't he? Tell you what I'm going to do for just $29.99, right? Okay. I'm going to give you, if you can do this for me, I'll do this for you. If you can do all of this, you shall be clothed with purple. You'll wear a chain of gold around your neck. And in that society, you didn't wear gold chains unless the king gave you the gold chain to wear and the king put it on you. Then you had the right to wear it. You can wear a gold chain. And you'll be the third ruler in the kingdom. Give me what I want, and I'll give you something to make your day. I'll give you power that you never had before. I'll benefit you in ways that nobody else can benefit you. Daniel's unimpressed. Verse 17. Then Daniel answered and said before the king, "Let your gifts be for yourself. Give them to somebody else. I'm not in this for the money. I'm not in this for the power. I'm not in this for the prestige. I don't play the games that you play." He says that this truth that you ought to have known. In fact, you have known the truth, but you've not known what to do with this truth. And he's going to get around to answering the king's question. He says, I'll tell you. Nevertheless, I will read the writing to the king and make known to him the interpretation. And he's not being bold. He's not being arrogant. He's not going to say, I can do this. It's still with the idea that there's a God who can give this to me. But he doesn't even reference that. Because the point is that he's already stuck his finger in the eye of this God. This is possible. But I want you to get to know the God that you've just stuck your finger in his eye. I want to tell you about the God that you don't believe there is, the one that you've said no to all these years. And he starts to rehearse the history that Belshazzar knew. In fact, he probably knew it firsthand. He was part of this courtly people. He probably witnessed this insanity of Nebuchadnezzar. And so he rehearses this history. Verse 18, O king, the Most High God gave Nebuchadnezzar, your father, kingship. But he didn't just give him kingship. You have kingship. But God gave to this king greatness. God gave to this king glory. God gave to this king majesty. God gave to this king something you never have and never will. God gave this to him. But it was the Most High God who gave this to him, in contrast to what you have. But because of the greatness that he gave him, all peoples, nations, languages trembled and feared before him. They didn't come and surround him. They didn't flex their muscles against him. If they did, they were dead. And so he goes through and he says, whoever he wanted, he would kill, he would keep alive, he would raise up, or he would humble. He was absolute, sovereign, Lord of the universe, under God, because God gave that to him. If ever anybody had something to be proud of, this man did, and he was. And so God, who gave him all this glory, verse 20, when his heart was lifted up, his spirit was hardened against this God so that he dealt proudly. He was brought down, and the idea is he was brought down by God. He was brought down from his kingly throne. His glory was taken away from him by God, by this most high God, by this living God that you have defied. He was driven away from man, and he talks about this position, until he knew that the most high God rules the kingdom of mankind, and he puts over it whomever he will. He's a king, can do what he wants, but there's a God who does whatever he wants with kings. And this king had to learn it. And he had to learn that there is a most high God who is the most high God who's absolutely alive. Verse 22, now you, Belshazzar, his son, you who stand in the line of the kings of Babylon, you have not humbled your heart. In these two verses, 14 times he uses the word you or yours. You have not humbled your heart. Your wives, your concubines, your lords, you've exalted yourself against the God of heaven, the Lord of heaven, verse 23. You've lifted up yourself. You've challenged. You've stuck your finger in his eye. You've grabbed that goblet as though you were grabbing God by the throat, saying, I am king, throwing your head back. He says, just keep your neck in that position because God's about to slice your throat. I want you to understand, you don't grab God by the throat. He's going to tell him exactly what happens. End of verse 23. You've praised the gods of silver. Note he reverses the order. You've praised the gods of silver and gold. It used to be gold, then silver. What's happening? He's saying you've praised these inanimate gods made of all these materials, but it's no longer gold at the head. It's kingdom number two. Silver's at the head. And this is exactly when this exchange is taking place. You've praised these gods, but the God in whose hand is your breath, the one who owns all your paths, you've not honored him. You thought you had God by the throat? Let me tell you, he holds you in his hand. He puts breath in your mouth, and when he wants, it's gone. It's done. You're nothing. He's real. You worship gods that are nothing. You're nothing in the hand of the God who's real. And so he comes to the king and he says, you've known this truth, but you've not known what to do with it. You know that God brings down the proud. You know the last verse of chapter 4. Now I, Nebuchadnezzar, praise and extol and honor the King of heaven. All his works are right, his ways are just, and those who walk in pride he's able to humble. That's the last word before we come to King Belshazzar. He says, you know this, and yet you didn't do anything with it. Then we move on just a little bit farther, and we find that he receives a verdict that's absolutely terrifying. I'll read the message. Verse 25, this is the handwriting that was inscribed. Mene, mene, tekel, u, farsin, says in the King James. U there is the letter that means and in the Aramaic. Mene, mene, tekel, and parson. And parson is a plural. He's going to translate it as a singular. What's happening here is the word mene, tekel, and peres. It refers as a noun to different weights. Weights that would be 60 shekels, the mina. The tekel was the same as the shekel, which was like our dollar. And then the peres was half. It just means half. It was half a mina, half a shekel. In the Babylonian archives that we have available to us, it was usually half a mina that the peres was referring to. But they refer to weights. And as he's talking about weights and also their values, he translates them as verbs, which are very close to the nouns. Mina has the idea of as a verb being numbered. The tekel has the idea of being weighed, but because it's such a small weight, the idea is it's a light weight, is the idea. You've been numbered, you've been weighed and found wanting, you're light. And divided. And so this is God's estimation of this king. He says, King, understand that the God who holds you in his hand, you don't hold him in your hand. He's numbered your days, and those days are coming to an end. I want you to understand that God has weighed your life, and you're a lightweight, buddy. There's nothing to tip the scales in your favor. And I want you to understand that it's God himself who is dividing your kingdom. And that word Perez is also similar to the Aramaic word for Persia. He's divided your kingdom, and he's given it over to the Medes and to the Persians. It's done. It's done. With one sweeping blow, you have annihilated not just yourself, not just your kingdom. You've handed over history to a different empire altogether. These are the last hours of the last king of Babylon forever. What an amazing historical sweep at this moment. God brings in this verdict that's absolutely terrifying, and the king then falls into a pit from which there's no return. So we come down to verse 29. He gives Daniel a robe. He gives Daniel this golden locket. He makes him the third in the kingdom. Bully. Rah, rah. It lasts for what? 25 minutes? An hour? 3 hours? Big deal. It's done. It's gone. It's worthless. Trinkets, garbage, garage sale material. It's history. So we come down to the end of the story, and we see that very night, Belshazzar, the Chaldean king, was killed. And a totally new empire is set up as Darius the Mede comes to the throne. Now note what it says here. It puts it in the passive. And Darius the Mede received the kingdom. Oh, but look at the verse before it. The Chaldean king was killed. Again, that's a passive. Who's the active one in this story? Who's the one doing the killing? Who's the one doing the giving? It's a God who's alive. It's a God who's real. It's a God who writes on the wall. As we come to the end of this story, there's some take-home points that I want us to catch. And don't miss these, please, because these are so important. I want us to see first that sin is not just a matter of indulgence, but sin is a matter of blasphemy and rebellion and idolatry. Why would God cast a person into hell for sin? Because your sin is against a God who's holy. And when you sin against God, you demean God. You make him as though he were little or nothing, and you replace him altogether with something that you bow down to its feet as God. God will deal with your sin, which is never just about indulgence. It's always about blasphemy and idolatry. I want us to see second that our greatest danger is not in gathering information, but in applying the information that we've been given. None of us in this room is without access to this, right? None of us. All of us have access to this. What are you doing with this? What are you doing with this? Are you just getting it here? Or are you letting this change the way you do life? It's not so much a matter of information as it is about a matter of application. Because when truth is rejected, the truth that would bring mercy becomes a truth that must bring judgment. If you reject the truth that there is a God who is holy and who demands holiness from all who would enter into his presence, if you reject this truth that he can make you holy, if somehow you think that you can earn holiness, that you, like Nebuchadnezzar, can build your own kingdom, that you can reach your way to God, what I wanted to do was give you mercy, but now I must give you judgment. We've got to see that there's coming a day when we must give account of our lives to the judge of all the universe. Note what the Bible says. It says, every one of us must stand before God. It says in Romans 14:10, we will all stand before the judgment seat of God. 1 Corinthians 3, verse 13, each one's work will become manifest because the day will disclose it. It'll be revealed by fire to test what sort of work each one has done. Acts 17, verse 31, God has fixed a day in which he will judge the world in righteousness by a man that he's appointed, because the Father judges no one, but he's given judgment to the Son. 2 Corinthians 5, verse 10, we must all appear before the judgment seat of Christ so that each one may receive what is due for what he's done in the body, whether good or evil. Hebrews 4, verse 13, no creature is hidden from his sight. All are naked and exposed before the eyes of him before whom we must give an account. My friend, if you get nothing else from this message, get this, please. One day, you, by yourself, with no cronies, with no buddies, holding no mama's hand, you, yourself, will stand in front of a God to whom you must give account. And he's not going to be your bud, he's going to be your judge. But here's the thing. Only the gospel can afford us a favorable verdict in the presence of Almighty God. Listen again to what the Bible tells us. We're told it in Psalm 32. Blessed is the man whose transgression is forgiven, whose sin is covered. Blessed is the man against whom the Lord counts no iniquity, in whose spirit there's no deceit. Romans 8, there is therefore now no condemnation for those who are in Christ Jesus. For God has done what the law, weakened by the flesh, could not do. In sending his own Son in the likeness of sinful flesh, and for sin he condemned sin in the flesh. Romans 3, for all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God, and are justified by his grace as a gift through the redemption that's in Christ Jesus, whom God put forward as a propitiation by his blood, so that he might be just and the justifier of those who believe in Jesus. My friend, you are no better than Belshazzar. You have chased down the false gods of money, sex, power, food. You can write in the blank the things that you've chased other than God, those wells that you've drunk that don't satisfy. You, like Belshazzar, have been given an opportunity, if never before, in this service to hear the fact that God is your judge. What will you do with that? Because God, as judge, has judged one in your place. He's written the condemnation in his flesh, in his blood on the cross, and he offers this one to you and says, will you believe him? Will you trust him? Will you receive him? But if you say no, this one must judge you for that decision as well. Because there's no other way under heaven given among men by which man must be saved. He is the way, the truth, the life, and no man can come to the Father except through him. My friend, if you don't come through Jesus, you don't come. You will be rejected. As we work through this text, we see that the fool is only fooling himself, and he can only do that for a little while. He can only do it for a little while. Because there's an end coming.